Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight I want to welcome Terry Lovelace. He has an undergraduate degree in psychology and a Juris Doctor from Western Michigan University. He worked in private practice, mostly in civil litigation and criminal defense. He entered public service as an assistant attorney general for the United States Territory of American Samoa. He later retired as an assistant attorney general from the state of Vermont in 2012. He lives in Dallas, Texas with his wife of 44 years and family. He served in the United States Air Force from 1973 to 1979 and had an alien abduction in 1977 while he was on active duty. He was trained as a medical EMT and drove an ambulance at Whitman Air Force Base for his entire enlistment. He is author of The Incident at Devil's Den. Terry, welcome. How are you tonight?
Thank you, Chris. I'm well. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I've been looking forward to this. But before we get started, I just want to thank our sponsor, My Patriot Supply. 2020 keeps getting stranger and more difficult, and things don't seem like they're going to get better anytime soon, although I really hope they will. It may be a while until we return to our old lives, so please be prepared for anything, including food storage. Make sure that tomorrow's survival is your top priority today by building an emergency food supply right now. I use My Patriot Supply. You can too. They are the go-to experts in emergency preparedness. Right now, you can save $100 on a full 4-week supply of their food that lasts up to 25 years, and it tastes awesome. So don't let yourself get caught unprepared. Go to preparewithfkn.com right now or click the link in the description. That's preparewithfkn.com. Now, Terry, thank you again for joining us. Like I said, I've been looking so forward to this. And the more details I read from your book and hear your story in your interviews, the more I want to know about it. It is fascinating and it's terrifying at the same time. But it, like I was telling you before, it's so great that you finally came out to tell your story. And from what I hear, that it is also helping a lot of others to come out and share their experience as well. What I'd like to start with tonight is by telling us what finally made you come out and want to share your experiences.
Sure. I'll be clear. I had no intention of ever sharing this story with anyone. It was between my wife and I. She was with me in 77. We'd been together 46 years. And, I made my living in the law. And unfortunately, there are some professions, academia, air traffic controllers, law enforcement, certain professions where if you come out with a story like this, it's the end of your career. It certainly would have been the end of my civil service career. And, what made me decide to do this was I woke up and I retired from state of Vermont as state's attorney in January of 2012. And my wife and I moved to Dallas, Texas to be with our adult kids and two grandkids. And in October of 2012, I got up, threw my legs over the bed one morning and went to stand, and I couldn't put pressure on my right knee. And I fell. And I told my wife, something's wrong with my knee. I need to go to the ER and have it x-rayed or something. And she's like, yeah, let's go. And she took me, I get all my medical care from the VA. And She took me to the Dallas North VA, and I saw a physician's assistant who was very kind and very knowledgeable, and she wheeled me into the x-ray room, and she took two shots and came out and said, I'm going to take these over, and took two shots and two more shots, and I hadn't even removed my pants. She did the first one through my pant leg and had me remove my pants for a better shot. And then she asked me, she said, have you been in an accident or suffered a shrapnel wound, something that would account for a piece of metal in your leg and some foreign bodies? And I said, no, I never left the States, and I've never injured that leg other than, you know, skinned knee as a kid. And she says, well, you've got some odd artifacts in your leg. And she said, I've called the radiologist. He's going to come down and take a look. So the radiologist comes down and he walks into the x-ray room 20 minutes later, obviously annoyed. And he looks at the x-rays on an x-ray view box, two of them, one from a front angle of my knee, kind of like front to back, and then the other with my leg bent sideways. So he walks over to me and he pokes me in the leg and says, you're going to have a scar here. And I said, doctor, I don't have a scar there. And he says, well, it's not possible for these objects. And he puts them up on the view box, and I saw them, and it was just, I was stunned that these things are in me. And he says, it's impossible for these things to breach the integrity of your skin and be buried deep in the fascia and tissue, and there not be a scar.
And, what did these objects look like?
I don't know if I sent you, I'm really remiss if I didn't send you copies.
Can check my email though. What did it look like whenever you saw it yourself?
Yeah, above my knee, and I'll send them to you if you don't have them. Above my knee, there's a fingernail-sized square object with two wires attached. And the wires run up my leg. And below my leg, there's a collection of what looks like bone or something. But it's arranged in the middle of, it's in the middle of my calf muscle, and it's arranged in a symmetrical pattern. So what the doctor said was, the doctor was freaked out that there wasn't a scar. And I asked him, doctor, how often is it that you see a foreign body in the human, a foreign object in a human body, and there not be a corresponding scar? And he said, never. And he said, I've been a radiologist 23 years. I've never seen this happen. So the thing above my knee, to answer your question, again, is a fingernail size with two wires attached. Below my leg is that collection of bone or something arranged in a floral pattern, a little dot in the middle, and it's right in the middle of my calf muscle. And he said that it's odd to see, he said, normally, bone doesn't spontaneously sprout in the middle of a calf muscle or any muscle. And he said, much less arrange itself in a symmetrical pattern. And he thought it was very strange. He was, you know, taken aback by this. And what it did for me was, it was like a slap in the face. I mean, that's it. I knew immediately that this thing related back to my 1977 event. And when that reality set in real quick, it drove home that these things had put their hands on me. And I just flipped out. I just couldn't, I wanted these things out of my leg as soon as possible. So it was frightening. And that was the catalyst for me to write this book. I might add that when I was going through this, I kept a journal on loose leaf binders. I filled two loose leaf binders because I didn't know if I was going to be charged with a crime by the Air Force. So I thought it would be good to have my story recorded. So when I went to write this book, my wife flew to Michigan to our storage locker and found those loose leaf binders and brought them back. And that's what I used to write this book. I mean, most of it's from memory anyway, but it was nice to have the written help there to refresh my memory.
Now, prior to the event that happened in 1977, have you ever had any strange or paranormal or even UFO sightings before that?
You know, I did. They were brief and they were benign, I hope. The first one being in 1963, when I was at the age of 8, and I was in my backyard, and I was playing with a bow and arrow. And I'm looking down, I'm loading an arrow into the notch of the bow, and I saw this, it's a beautiful May day, not a cloud in the sky, sunshiny, and it's in St. Louis, Missouri, in the city. We lived in a row house with neighbors right next to us all over, and there were women hanging up laundry and dogs and cats and kids running around all over the place, and cars, and it was loud, and I looked down and I saw this brown shadow move across my feet. And as I did, I looked up, and when I looked up, I saw this, what I called back then, a flying saucer. And it was about, I'm a bad judge of distance at age 8, but I'd say 30 or 40 feet above my head. And the thing was relatively large, maybe 30 feet in diameter. And the peculiar thing was, there was a weird auditory change as soon as I laid eyes on it. I mean, the sounds of the neighborhood became muffled. I mean, it sounded like I pressed my hands against my ears. And that was strange. And I had an electrical charge, the hair on my arms stood up. And I looked up at this thing, and I dropped my bow and arrow, and I was just absolutely blown away. It was beautiful. I mean, when I say it's beautiful, it was beautiful in the way, if you went to a new Alfa Romeo showroom and you saw a brand new sports car, it was beautiful like that. You know, it was just a work of art, I felt. And just a solid sheet of, looked like polished aluminum with the edges that curled up, and it wobbled a little bit in the breeze. And I had this crazy idea. I said, I should lie down on the grass and look up to get a better view of it. And that makes no sense. I don't know why I did that, but that's what I did. And as I'm watching it, it does this kind of list to starboard, tilts, and shoots off from 0 to 500 miles an hour in a blink of an eye, and it's gone. You know, and I'm screaming, Mom! You know, and my mother comes running out, thinks I probably shot a neighbor with an arrow or something, and checks me for blood and says, stop screaming. And she refused to believe me. My parents refused to believe that I saw a UFO. And I had real trouble reconciling that. Because I was a pretty straight kid. You know, I didn't lie, I didn't tell tales. So 3 years later, on a bitterly cold January night, I went to bed, and while I'm in bed, in the middle of the night, I don't know what time, I wake up and the whole room is flooded with yellow, green, and yellow, white lights, multicolored lights. And my, we lived in an old house, it was drafty, so we had Venetian blinds and then heavy curtains over that. And it was, the light was bright enough to shine through all that. And I thought, my first thought was, a fire truck, must be a fire truck outside. So I hopped out of bed and I went to the window and I pulled back the curtain and raised the blind, and there it was. I mean, right outside my second story bedroom window was, it may have been the same one. I don't know. There was a flying saucer. There was another disc, silver disc, the lights. And I remember feeling really privileged to be able to see the top of the thing. Because I didn't get to see the top before, I only saw the bottom. And there was a dome in the center that was emitting the light. That's where the light was coming from. And there was this weird fog underneath the thing, a big cloud of fog or something. And I got tired of holding the sled up. What I did was I pulled the curtain back and I tucked it into the Venetian blind so I could watch it with my hands free. And I watched for a while, and then I just kind of felt weirdly disinterested, And I went back to bed, you know. And the family dog didn't wake up. Nobody else in the family woke up. And, you know, I got up the next morning, and I didn't remember this at first. But when I got up, I saw that curtain tucked into the blind, and then it just came flooding back, and I knew, oh, yeah, that's what happened last night. So that was my second experience. Not very dramatic and benign, like I said, but then I was 11 at that time, 1966. Then I had an 11-year hiatus of no UFO activity or anything paranormal, just a normal late adolescence. And then 1977 happened. And, you know, that was really a pivotal point in my life. I mean, you know, my friend and I went down to do this camping trip, which was a stupid idea, really. But
now, in 1977, how old were you?
I was 22.
And you were, at this time, you were in the Air Force?
Yes. Yes, I was active duty Air Force at Whiteman Air Force Base. My friend, who I went with, Toby, we worked the night shift in the emergency room from 11 o'clock p.m. to 7 a.m. And my friend Toby approached me and said, man, I got an idea. Let's go camping. And I'm like, Toby, are you nuts, man? He was from Flint, Michigan. I knew he'd never been camping in his life. I knew I had never been camping in my life. But I did have a brand new camera. And we both lived on NCO housing on the base. And it was a nuclear base at the time. It had B-52s with nuclear weapons and a squadron of Minuteman II ICBM missiles spread out all over the countryside. And when you live on a nuclear base, there's not a lot you can do with a camera. So I the idea of going down to this state park and taking some pictures of wildlife started to grow on me. And I agreed, yeah, let's go. And we did. And, you know, I find out later that there is a dark past about this place. I mean, it has a dark history. I talk about that in the beginning of my book.
What kind of history does it have?
Well, I approached the Parks Department, and I wanted to get a list of deaths and missing persons, and did a FOIA request, did everything the way you're supposed to do it, and they said, we don't maintain these records. We don't have any records. So I ended up speaking with someone about my FOIA request, and I said, you know, every small town sheriff in this country can tell you how many missing people they have from their community, and you can't tell me? And he says, no, we don't keep those records. And I thought that was very odd. And then I heard from David Politis that he had the same experience. And so I did my research. I researched people missing from Devil's Den State Park, northwestern Arkansas. And I found a 1947 article in the Pittsburgh Press that just was insane. It blew me away. And as a matter of fact, David Politis, in his fourth volume, The Devil Is in the Details, talks about this case. It's a case of Catherine Van Alst. And the Van Alst family was from Pittsburgh, and they were driving to see relatives in El Paso with the intention of spending the night at Devil's Den. So they stayed at the campground, and the first morning that they were there, you know, the kids are running around the camper like kids will do. Catherine, age 8, and her two younger siblings, brothers, and mom's setting the picnic table, and the two boys run around, but there's no Catherine. So the mother notices this and says, boys, where's your sister? And he says, well, she's right here. And she's annoyed, and she says, we'll go find her. So they run to the bathroom, they call her name. You know, the dad gets up out of the camper and comes outside, and they start looking. They get adjoining campers, join in the search. She's in a swimsuit with flip-flops. She can't have gone very far. So by noon, this was early in the morning, and by noon they have park rangers involved, both from Devil's Den State Park and from the federal park on the opposite side, from Ozark National Forest, had joined in the search. And it became a massive search effort, entailing, you know, 2,500 acres and thousands of people. And it was to last 7 days, And after the seventh day, it would transition from a rescue to a recovery mission. And there was a volunteer from University of Arkansas. The Pittsburgh Press and the Kansas City Star refer to him just as Chadwick, so I don't know if it's a first name or a last, but he was a student from Arkansas State. And he was on top of like a cliff at an elevation of almost 800 feet from where they camped. Now, to get to this height, she would have had to walk about 5 miles of, you know, winding trails that went back and forth to get to the top of this thing. And he's up there, and the place has been searched twice before. And while he's up there, he calls her name, and when he yells out, Catherine, she crawls out from underneath a limestone over a piece of limestone rock with some, like a little cave underneath. She comes out and she says, here I am. And they found her. And what's crazy is that she hadn't lost an ounce of weight. Her hair was clean. Other than a few bug bites, she had no injuries whatsoever. She was well hydrated. And this is despite the fact that there was no potable water up there anywhere. So really strange story. And in the Pittsburgh Press article, the mother is quoted that when asked about her daughter's mood, she said, my daughter was utterly serene. And that just seems out of context. Catherine said that she didn't remember anything until that morning. Has no idea what happened to her. Crazy story, man.
That is crazy.
When I'm writing this book in 2017, in August of 2017, there's a 32-year-old man from Bartlesville, Oklahoma, named Rodney Letterman, who was walking on the Butterfield Trail, not that far from where we camped, and he had asthma or something. And he stopped on the trail, and he said to his friend, he said, would you run back to the truck and grab my inhaler? And his friend says, sure, no sweat. So his friend runs back to the truck, I don't know how far, grabs the inhaler, comes running back. When he comes back, there's no Rodney Letterman. He's gone. And all they found was his cell phone on the ground.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And bloodhounds from Russellville Police Department brought in, and they got a scent from the phone and sat down, whatever that means. And there was a massive search. Again, hundreds, thousands of people using helicopters with forward-looking infrared radar, looking for a heat signature from the guy, and never found anything. And that's what I say in my book. However, after my book was on the was up on Amazon after March of 2018, there was an article. They found him in March of 2019 is when they found him. And what happened was someone was walking along the Butterfield Trail, and there was a log right off the trail. And sitting on top of that log, which was in open view for everyone to see, there was a piece of bone. And some guy picked it up and said, this looks human. It was the skull cap. It was the top of Rodney Letterman's skull. It was sent to Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where the medical examiner did a DNA analysis on it and confirmed positively that it was the skull cap of Rodney Letterman. So crazy, crazy place.
Wow. Now, let's get into your story. Take us through that day at Devil's Den in 1977.
I can sure do that. We left Whiteman Air Force Base, and it's about a 6.5-hour drive, so we left early in the morning. And we just felt on top of the world. We were just really psyched to go on this trip. And on the way down, my friend said, you know, let's not stay at the campground. And I'm like, why? You know, if we stay in the campground, we have electricity, we got hot showers. And he's like, yeah, but think about it. You know, we're going to have people to the right of us, people to the left of us. You know, you might as well camp in Walmart's parking lot. And I thought, you know, that's kind of a good point. So we decided that we were going to find our own place. And we took a paved road till it turned to gravel, till it turned to two ruts in the road. And then we came to a chain across the road with a very sternly worded keep out sign warning. And I thought, well, you know, we'll go back and find another route. And my friend says, no, wait a minute. He hops out of the car. And what they've done is they've taken that chain and just made a noose and clicked it with a padlock and just draped that over the pole post on the opposite side of the road. So he gets out of the car, picks up the chain, drops it, falls to the ground, and we drove right in. And we were looking for a piece of high ground, and we could see one in the distance. And my friend Toby, who had an unerring sense of direction anyway, he was able to get us there. And we drove up this incline and crested the top of this thing. And I call it a meadow in the book. And I say that it's horseshoe shaped. That was based on walking it. When I wrote the book, I didn't bother to Google Earth to see if the place was still there, because I assume, you know, it's got to be covered with 40-year-old mature trees by now. But it's not. It's still there. It's a high plateau, almost triangular shaped. And that's where we set up camp. It was a gorgeous place. We had a beautiful view of the surrounding forest, and we set up our tent on a tree line. And, you know, we did all the fun stuff you do when you're camping. You know, we set up our little Walmart tent, and we had our sleeping bags, some blankets we took from the hospital, and built a fire, and just having a pleasant evening. And I recall telling my friend, you know, I could see why people like this. This is pretty cool. And he says, yeah, you know, I told you. And we're laughing and cutting up, and then there's a lull in our conversation. Now, and I know this sounds cliche, and I almost apologize for it, but it's the God's truth that this place went dead silent. I mean, it was dead silent. There were 15 minutes earlier, there were tree frogs and crickets and noises of the forest all over the place, and now it's just quiet. And not only was it quiet, but it was still. We lost the breeze that we'd had earlier, and it unnerved me, and I asked my friend, you know, hey, Toby, man, is this normal to be this quiet? And he's like, oh, you know, like he would know, right? And he said, yeah, you know, we've been laughing and cutting up. The crickets, the tree frogs, they'll come back. Just wait, they'll come back. And I said, okay. So, but I still wasn't at ease. And a few minutes later, he has his head turned to the left, looking at something, and he's kind of fixated on it. And I'm about to ask him, what are you looking at? And he asked me, he says, hey, Terry, were those lights there before? And the lights were his torso. He was sitting up on the air mattress. His torso was blocking them. I couldn't see them. So I had to take a step back and stand up, and then I could see on the horizon there were these three bright stars, and they were formed a perfect little triangle. And they were too far above the horizon to have been from a train or a parking lot or something. But they were absolutely stationary, so we didn't think it was an aircraft. I mean, we knew a little bit about aircraft. I mean, we didn't know of any plane that had that triangle-like configuration. Because sometimes, you know, if you're looking at a plane and it's headed right in your direction, it'll appear stationary when it's actually moving. So we gave it a few minutes and we're looking at it. And finally, this thing moves. And as it does, it rotates like it's on an axis and makes a turn. And it it turned in such a way that it aligned the base of the triangle with the horizon, parallel to the horizon, with the apex of the triangle pointed up. And we're pretty excited about this, right? And then it starts to go up into the air. And at that moment, when it first moved up, I felt a wave of calm wash over me that I would say was very close to sedation. It was weird, you know. It was like when I was 11 looking at that flying saucer and I had that disinterest and went back to bed. That's what this was like. It was like an odd disinterest. I mean, it wasn't apathy. I don't know really the best words to explain it, but it was more like I was an observer than a participant in this matter. It is strange. So my buddy must be in the same frame of mind, because our conversations stopped. I mean, had we had our wits about us, we'd have gotten in the car and got out of there, because it was frightening, or it should have been frightening. It wasn't frightening at the time. And this thing climbed into the sky, and as it climbed, it did this tumbling thing where from the point of the apex seemed to be the direction where it was headed, it would tumble where it would go end over end like this. And we'd see two lights, three lights, two lights as it tumbled. And I recall that I had a feeling that this thing was moving with purpose. You know, it wasn't just out of control and tumbling in the air. It was moving with purpose. So we watch it, and it gets closer, and we could see it move across the floor of the, we see the shadow of it move across the floor of the forest. Even with these lights on the apex of each, on the point of each part of the triangle, it was a very bright night. There were just a trillion stars out. And the sky itself was a deep blue, but the area inside this triangle was jet black. So we could see, well, it verified that it was a single solid object and not three objects moving in unison. And it was very big. It was big. And the closer it got, the bigger it got. And it came to a stop about 3,000 feet over our heads. It was immense. I mean, it was the size of a Walmart. And, you know, to this day, I don't know why this thing wasn't seen in five counties. But I checked, and there were no reports. No reports. So we're watching this thing. And again, I feel these waves of calm wash over me. And from the middle of this thing... And the middle of the thing is just black, because there's no light source on it. It's just jet black. From the middle of this triangle and underneath, there came a white light. And it, like, boom, like someone flipped the switch, and it landed square in the middle of our campfire. And it had that quality like a high-power searchlight cutting through fog. You know, there's a column of light that's visible. That's what this was like. And it was about 6 inches in diameter, and it landed in our, if I can say it, right in the middle of our...
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Campfire, which was about 60 seconds maybe. And then again, like someone flipped a switch, it went off. And then immediately after that went off, a laser came from the exact same place. Now, 1977, lasers were kind of a new concept, and I'd only seen them on television. And this was a bluish purple light, about the diameter of a pencil. And it would land at a spot in our campsite and stay there for like a tenth of a second, and then reappear in another place for a tenth of a second. So this thing was in a second dancing 10 times all over our campsite. And it hit me in the chest a couple times. It hit our car, our tent. I didn't feel anything. But I remember thinking, this thing's checking us out. This thing's scanning us somehow. I mean, it just seemed like the logical conclusion. And we watched it, again, with minimal interest. And as soon as it turned off, my friend said, show's over. And I recall thinking, all I wanted to do was go to sleep. I had never been so tired in my life. And it makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, I'd add that, you know, we had worked 3 years on the night shift. I mean, you know, midnight was like afternoon to us. So, I mean, we were tired from the drive, but we should not have been sleepy. I mean, we were like sedated. My friend walks over, he throws his air mattresses into the tent and just kind of falls on top of them. And I followed suit. It was a small tent. I threw mine in. And, you know, I didn't bother to take off my boots or take off my shirt. And that would kind of be important later, and I'll explain. I fell on top of this air mattress, and I was out. I mean, boom, I was absolutely, the second my head hit the pillow, I was out. And about 4.5 hours pass, and I woke up with this flood of green and yellow and white lights, brilliant lights, at flashing at odd intervals. And a low droning noise, like if you've ever stood next to a locomotive or a big piece of industrial machinery, they make a noise that's more powerful than it is loud. You can feel it in your chest. That's what this noise was like. And the evening before, we didn't hear anything when this thing was over our heads. So, and I'm confused. I don't have my wits about me. And I'm thinking, these lights, they're probably the overhead lights from a park ranger's truck here to kick us out. And I got to my knees and I realized I was hurting. And I looked down and my boots are undone. They've been unlaced halfway down. And you know, the military teaches you to take care of your feet. You know, I just would never do that. I took off my boot and I noticed my sock is on sideways. Now I know that I didn't do that. So I'm annoyed and confused and I put them on properly and laced my boots up. And I glance over at my friend during one of these flashes of bright lights. And because when the light's not flashing, it's pitch dark. And when the light flashed, I could see he's on his knees and he's looking at something outside the left side of the tent through the flap. And in one of the flashes of light, I could see he had tracks of tears down his right side of his face. And that scared me. That scared me because I could not imagine what would make this guy cry. I mean, it didn't make sense. And I asked him, I said, Toby, what is it, man? What's out there? Is it park rangers? And he kind of, you know, puts his fingers across his lips in the universal sign, you know, be quiet. And he said, they're still out there. And I said, who's still out there, Toby? And I got to my knees and I got in front of my tent. And he leans on me, and he's kind of sobbing. And I look out my flap of the tent, and I see two things. I see that this thing that was 3,000 feet over our campsite has descended, and this thing is now just 30 feet over this meadow. I mean, 30 feet. It's like three stories. And underneath this thing, the lights on the points are very bright. And they're flashing. That's where the flashing lights are coming from. And the inside of this thing was lit up, too. There were windows, and it was putting out an amazing amount of light. And I could see underneath this thing, there were what I took to be kids, about 12 to 15 little kids. And I asked Toby, man, what are these kids doing out here? We're in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. What are they, you know? And he said, Terry, man, those ain't no little kids. Don't you remember? They took us and they hurt us. And as soon as he said that, I was absolutely scared out of my wits. And I had flashes of memory from being inside this thing. And I remembered that, yeah, they did hurt us. You know, they didn't kill us, thankfully. But
now, did you get a good look at what they looked like?
Yes. Well, you know, from a distance. I mean, we weren't... they were fairly far away, but I mean, that's why I took them to be children at first. But when I looked close, you could tell these weren't human beings. I mean, they were 3.5 foot tall. They were all uniform. They all looked the same. Appeared to be gray in color from top to bottom. I don't know if that was skin or some kind of tight-fitting garb that they were wearing. And they their heads were bulbous and large. I couldn't really get a good look because of the distance at facial features, but they had a very distinctive gait. When they walked with like their knees were hinged backward or something, or like they had sore feet. They had a very unusual gait. And, you know, they weren't looking at the ground. They were walking around like tourists. You know, they were looking around and checking things out. And I was just terrified. I mean, I was afraid these things were going to come back over to the tent.
At that point, what did you remember about actually being on the craft?
I had a couple flashes of memory. And these are scenes that I had spontaneously, and they've been the focus of nightmares for 40 years. And I'll kind of stop. I'll come back to the main story and tell you what I witnessed inside, because that's what people find so amazing. And I don't know if they took us aboard this thing and took us someplace else, or if we were actually inside the thing that we were looking at. And the reason I doubted that was the sheer size of this thing. I mean, it looked like a Walmart from the outside, but from the inside, it looked like a football stadium in size. So much so that I could not see the distance came to a point. I could not see the end of it. I don't know how large this thing was, I don't know where I was. Like Calvin Parker, very similar. Calvin and I had a long conversation, a couple of them, and he could only move his eyes and his head a little bit. I could move my eyes, but not my head. So my eyes are darting around, and I'm trying to take in everything that I can. And I was aware that my friend Toby was to my left, and my boots and my clothing were all in my hands like this, as were his. There were many, you know, many, many levels. This was like an open mezzanine, and I wasn't able to tilt my head to look up. I would like to have known how tall it really was and what was at the ceiling, but I couldn't get that vantage point. So I heard a woman scream. I remember that. And it was a sharp scream. I mean, it wasn't, you know, you can jump out and grab someone and yell, boo, and they'll scream. But, you know, if you're experiencing pain, there's a different character to your scream. And this woman sounded like she was hurting, and that scared me. And there were a couple other things I noticed. There were three flying saucers, three discs, lined up like planes below a carrier deck. In a perfect line to my left and far away. And there were these little gray guys running all over the place. And I have a theory about them. And Calvin Parker agrees with me. I don't think these things are living sentient beings like you and I, at least the ones that we ran into. I think these things are some kind of combination of artificial intelligence and some biological material, nanotechnology, you know, quantum computing, who knows? I think they're manufactured, though. I don't think they're living sentient beings. And they're running around, they're all kind of, you can tell they're task-oriented. They're not just running around aimlessly. Everything that I see is either like stainless steel or white porcelain. And the lights inside of this thing are absolutely insane. I mean, it's like they've got, and the light seems to illuminate from every, I didn't see any light fixtures. The light illuminated from the walls, the floor, the ceiling. It was just, and that was one of the injuries that we suffered, was we both had what was called a flash burn to the eyes. It's what an arc welder would get if they didn't wear the mask and they looked at the it's a sunburn to the cornea of your eye. So I noticed that Toby was gone. I sensed that Toby was gone. And then I heard his voice, and I heard him say, "No, no, oh my God, no," and I heard him scream. And while this is going on, there's a 6-foot-tall, chalkish pink complexion, 6-foot-tall being that looks, you know, humanoid. And maybe just classic 2 dots for nostrils, a slit of a mouth, and his eyes were big, but they weren't exaggerated like on the motion pictures. They were just like a pair of wraparound Ray-Bans almost, you know? They were just that big. There were no ears that I could discern, no hair on top of his head. And he was wearing a gray uniform, and I remember that it had a V-neck. And I'm straining my eyes to the left to see this guy. And just by happenstance, he turns his head to the right, and we locked eyes. And that was the most frightening experience of being on the ship, was with that moment that we locked eyes. As soon as we locked eyes, and I don't know how to best explain this, but this guy was in my head. I mean, he was in my head. I mean, he knew my wife, he knew my secrets, he knew my ambitions, my failings, he knew everything about me. And you know what it's like. I got a dog, and my dog will come over and put his head in my lap, and I'll pet him, and he looks up at me with trust and love, and he knows I'm the alpha, you know? In this equation, I felt like I was the dog. I don't know what this thing was, but it had to be 500 rungs up the evolutionary ladder above us. It was intimidating. The intellect was intimidating to me. And that lasted a brief moment. And they came and got me. And I was like I was on the moving sidewalk that you see or you experience in airports. I was just gliding along the floor. And one of the gray guys took my clothing from my hand. And I'm going down a hallway, and we came to a big domed room at the end of the hallway with a white ceiling and what looked like a porcelain exam table. And the gray guys lifted me up and placed me on this table. And I remember thinking that I expected it to be cold to the touch, and it wasn't. It was warm. And then I realized it's warm because there have been bodies on this thing. And they were doing something to my lower back. And there was a being there that, now I'm sure this guy didn't wear a white lab coat, but this thing was a mantis. It looked like a praying mantis. And it was like 7 foot tall with the bulbous large eyes. It was green. And in my mind's eye, I picture him being in a white lab coat. And I got a vibe from him that he was medical or something. He wasn't as scary as the other guy that I saw, even though he was more frightening looks-wise. And I'm screaming. And I'm filling my lungs with air, and I'm screaming as loud as I can. And I can't hear anything. And I can't really, I can feel my chest expanding. I know I'm full of air. I can't really see it, because I'm positioned in supine on top of this table, but I can't hear myself scream. Well, evidently I was screaming, and I annoyed, you know, Dr. Bug and this.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Sent this big bulbous head in my direction, and with its left eye made eye contact with me, and I heard this thing, I swear, in my head, with crystal clarity. I heard it in the middle of my head. Why are you screaming? Stop screaming. You know we take you back. You know we don't hurt you. Now stop screaming. And he hit me on top of the head with a big green digit, and I was out. And that's pretty much the sum of my memory. I wish I had a clear linear memory of everything that happened. And I, you know, I might see Kathleen Martin or Yvonne Smith or someone and maybe do a regression. You know, Calvin recommended it. I'm not sure I'm ready for that yet. You know, I don't.
That's understandable. Definitely. And if you do have that, I'd love to have you back on to have further details about that for sure. Now take us back to the tent. Right after you realizing what's happening, Toby sobbing, what happens next?
Well, what happened next was, yeah, that's where I left off. After I took a moment and had these memories flash across my head, I felt panic. Toby was hyperventilating, and this sounds odd, but I, you know, to this day, I don't like to be out in the open. I mean, I'll walk a mile around out of the way to keep from cutting across an open field. But I felt like All we had over the top of our head was a piece of canvas, but I felt like it gave us cover. You know, I felt like we were hidden. And the thought of going outside was just not possible. And we watched this thing, and there came another white light with that same searchlight through fog quality to it. And this was a cylinder of white light that came from underneath the craft, to the ground, and it's about 25 feet in diameter. And these little guys who are paired up in twos and threes would walk over and walk into this light, and when they did, they would dissolve. Very much like the old Star Trek thing where they had the, and I wasn't a science fiction fan, but you know, they would dissolve. And that's what these things did. And when the last two guys walked into the light and dissolved, the light switches off, and the lights on the tips of the triangle change from multicolored to just white. And that droning noise that we've been hearing, and you know, when you hear a noise long enough, you kind of disregard it. So when it goes off, when it stops, when the noise stops, it's real evident. It's like, And that stopped. The noise stopped. And we're both peeking out of the tent, and we watched this thing take off. Now, and when I say take off, it didn't take off like a rocket ship, or it took off like a hot air balloon. It just lifted off. And it lifted off, and it went up. And we watched it. And the higher it climbed, the faster it went. And it was 3 points of light, and then a single point of light, and then gone. And my friend finally has his breathing under control. And we sat there for probably 30 minutes. I was afraid that one or two of those little guys might still be out there. I didn't know. I should tell you how we got back to the tent, because that's not a real vivid memory, because I was barely conscious, but I don't know how they got us there, but we were dumped kind of unceremoniously right next to my car. And I can't really move around, and I'm in a daze, and I'm thinking, boy, somebody screwed up. They should have put us back in the tent. And I no sooner thought that than these little gray guys came over and dragged us and threw us into the tent. So that's how we got back from the thing. Well, we after this thing took off, we sat there for probably 30 minutes, and my friend says, "Look, man, we got to go. You know, just grab your car keys, let's run to the car, and let's go." And I was concerned how are we going to find a way out of here, you know, pitch black. I said, you know, can you, and Toby reassured me, I can get us back. I know where to go. There were no landmarks. It was just trees everywhere. And when we were driving up, he had taken a pencil and a banknote, or a bank envelope out of my glove box and drawn like a little map. So when we went to leave, we'd know which way to turn to get out of there. And he was able to navigate us out of there, and we drove and got back to Blacktop, hit Blacktop, and headed back toward the base. And we were really hurting. Kind of an odd thing. Both of our watches, we had wind-up watches. This was before quartz were common. And we both wore watches because we were EMTs. They were, you know, what you needed for the job. Both of our watches had stopped at 240. And my watch never ran again. And it was a nice Elgin watch. It wasn't a cheap watch. I wish I'd saved it. But in the morning, when the sunshine came out, our eyes were just, I mean, it was like somebody threw sand in our eyes. Our eyes really, really hurt. We also were burned. I stopped to get gas, and I ran into the bathroom, and I was so thirsty. I'd never been so thirsty in my life, and I put my hands under this grungy, dirty faucet, and I'm just drinking and drinking and drinking, and I can't satisfy my thirst. And that's when I splash water in my face. I look in the mirror, and I see that I'm red, and I mean, I've got like this terrible sunburn. I never blistered, but I am like red all over. And what's crazy was I was red under my arms. Later, I'd find out the soles of my feet, you know, literally everywhere on my body. I had this burn, and that and the flash burn. And we got back to the base, and I dropped Toby off at his house, and I went to my home, which is just a few blocks away, and our wives both took us to the ER. My wife, after I drank all the lemonade I could hold, and she took my temperature, and I had like 103 fever. And I felt bad. And, you know, we worked at the hospital. I mean, these were our friends. We knew them. They're our coworkers. Everybody in the hospital squadron knew we were going on this dumb camping trip, too, you know. And so it was a little bit embarrassing, but you know what? I hurt so bad I didn't care. And they put us in different exam rooms. And the doctors went back and forth. And I had probably the most thorough medical exam I've ever had in my life. And toward the end of the exam, the base commander, who I knew of but didn't know, the hospital or squadron commander, I knew very well. He was a good guy. And there were two other guys there that were in civilian clothes and casual clothing. And the hospital, or the squadron commander, did all the talking. And he said to me, he said, "Sergeant Lovelace, you're to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias in any way, shape, or form, not verbally, not by phone, not in writing, not through third parties. You're not to give him anything. He's not to give you anything. If you run into him at the base exchange, you're to immediately turn around and walk in the opposite direction." And on and on and on. And then he's like, "Do you understand me, Sergeant?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." I mean, I really didn't understand. I mean, I knew what the words meant, but I didn't know the, I didn't understand the reason for it. And, you know, at this point, I should point out that something had changed. You know, we went down there. I feel like we went down there as two kids and came back as adults. We were different people. You know, before this, Toby was probably my best friend. We worked together. We played cards together. We barbecued. Our wives were friends. But I felt ambivalent about the guy. And I can't reconcile those feelings to this day. So, you know, this no contact order really was no big deal to me. And they put me in a private room, which was unusual, because usually enlisted men are placed in an open ward. And private rooms are reserved for officers and intensive care. And they put me in this room. They kept the lights turned off because my eyes, and treated my eyes with salve. Gave me an admitting diagnosis of acute dehydration and ran two IVs into me. And it was about 48 hours before I really started to feel back to normal. And I was in there for 3 days, two nights. And on the second evening, my night nurse came in, who I knew, with an injection for me. And as she walks into the room, these two guys in blue business suits followed her in. And the one guy says, if that's going to sedate Sergeant Lovelace, it's going to have to wait. We have to ask him a few questions. And they flash their badges. For those who may not know, OSI stands for Office of Special Investigations. The Air Force has a security police and then this special investigative branch called the OSI. OSI is kind of like to the Air Force as NCIS is to the Navy, if that makes sense. And these guys look like cops. I mean, they look like cops. Not to stereotype anyone, but you know, their suit coats are open. I could see they have a shoulder holster. They showed me their OSI badge and credentials. There was a guy about 50 who was a major, and then there was a younger guy in his early 30s who was much taller, who was a captain who said hardly anything. And the major takes this real tough guy stance, you know, and I'm scared to death. I mean, I've been lived a pretty straight life. I'd never been in trouble before. And I asked him, I said, sir, am I in some kind of trouble? And he had this Mississippi accent and he says, son, would we be here if you weren't in trouble? And then him and the captain get a laugh. You know, they think that's funny. They get a laugh out of that. You know, my stomach turns over. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what do? We burn the forest down or something? You know, what could we possibly have done? I mean, yeah, we trespassed. I admit that. But I didn't think that was a major crime. So I'll stress it. When we left there, when we left Devil's Den, we left everything there. We left our tent, blankets. Air mattresses, cooler, Toby's backpack with his name and address in it. So he lived on the base. They knew we were from the air base. So what happened was we didn't put that chain back up. If we put that chain back up, we might have been okay for a while. But the park rangers found that chain down and then drove up and found our campsite. And they called the base. And they said, it looks like a couple of your airmen have been down here, but it looks like they're planning on coming back. They left all their stuff. So this major says to me, he says, now, son, I got a question for you. Why would you set up this little permanent camp down there? You know, the only thing I can think of is that you got a little marijuana plot growing out there. Is that what this is all about? And that really scared me because in 1977, that, you know, would have been a dishonorable discharge and maybe Leavenworth. I mean, it was a big deal. And then I thought, well, you know, who knows? Somebody might, you know, just happen to have some marijuana growing out there. It wouldn't be unheard of. So I'm really scared. And he reads me my rights under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And I don't understand a word of it. And he swipes everything off my side table and rolls it under my chest. He flips on the overhead lights. And I'm like, sir, I really can't. That hurts my eyes. Could we work with the lights off, sir? And he said, you know, can't work in the dark. Got to see what we're doing, son. And he laid out six forms in front of me. And he gave me a pen, put it in my hand. And I said, sir, what are these? And he says, well, these are waiver and consent forms. These give us permission to take a look in your house and see if you've got a big bag of marijuana in your house or in the trunk of your car. You don't have a big bag of marijuana in the trunk of your car or in your house, do you? And I said, no, sir. And he said, well, then you wouldn't object to us taking a look, would you? And later on, I find out that that's, when you consent to a search, a consent search, that's one of the exceptions to needing a warrant. If you consent, you forfeit your right to object to the legality of the search. So these guys were pretty polished. I felt boxed. And I knew I didn't have any contraband. I knew I didn't have anything I wasn't supposed to have. So I'm like, sure, why not? And I signed the consent forms. And I signed six forms in total. I think one was an NDA. Not sure, don't really care. And one of them was a consent to hypnotic regression, memory enhancement by hypnotic regression with chemical enhancement. And that came to happen weeks later. So these guys finish off, and the captain leaves with these consent forms, and they went to my house and searched my home, scared my poor wife half to death, took my car, kept it 2 days, gave it back to us, and it was as clean as it was the day it came off the showroom floor. And I thought they did that to be nice, but in retrospect, I don't think it was to be nice. I don't know, what they were looking for. That sounds like a forensic examination of some kind. So the captain leaves, like I said, with these consent forms, and the major has me thoroughly intimidated. I'm scared of this guy. And the nurse came in and said, "Doctor wants Sergeant Lovelace to have this injection." And he says, "Well, give us just a minute. I'm just finishing up." And she said, "All right, I'll be back in 5. And she left. And he shut the door, and he got down right next to my ear. And this is just so important. And he said to me in a whisper, he said, "Son, I know, and you two knuckleheads stumbled onto something out there. And I think you know exactly what I mean." And I didn't answer. And I wasn't about to tell anybody, doctors or anyone, that we saw a UFO the size of Walmart, because we would have been on a psych ward. So I said, nothing. I didn't answer. So again, he says, "Oh, I know you know what I mean. And all I need is your film and your camera. And by the way, how many pictures did you take of it?" And this is when I answered him, and I shouldn't have said anything, but I messed up, and I did. And I said, "Sir, I never took a single picture." And that confirmed in his mind. I think he already knew. He knew what we saw. I don't know how he knew, but he knew. And it was crazy. Toby had his backpack right next to him. I actually left my camera at home, which is crazy, out of character for me. But Toby had a camera in his backpack. And the thought of taking a picture of this thing never crossed our mind. It never crossed our mind. I don't get it. But it didn't. So he leaves. And I'm under this no contact order. But I do want to say goodbye to my friend. They cut orders for him to go to Japan. And they did this at light speed. And we were coming home from the base exchange. We went grocery shopping one day, and we're in my wife's Carmen Ghia, so she's driving. And Toby lived just a couple blocks from me. And the most direct way home was drive right past his house. And I asked my wife, I said, "Would you please stop? I just want to say goodbye to Toby." And she said, "Terry, these OSI people scare me. You're under an order, and I don't think you should do this." And I'm like, "Look, I owe the guy that. He was my best friend for a long time, and he's leaving, and I just feel compelled. I need to do this." And she relented, and I said, "Look, I'll be back in 4 minutes. No problem." And I hopped out of the car, and I walked up to the door, the front door, the same one I've walked through 100 times before. And I went in the house, and I saw his wife, Tammy. And it was obvious they were packing, getting ready to move. And she just glares at me and says, "You're not supposed to be here." And I said, I know, I just want to say goodbye to Toby and wish you guys well. Well, Toby was in the bedroom and heard this. And he comes out, and he comes around the corner and walks down the hallway. And I'm shocked, because he's a wreck. I mean, he's a mess. Now, I don't know all what they did to us, but whatever they did to me, they gave him a double dose. And he was messed up. He was unshaven. His hair was all messed up. He was wearing dirty clothes. He was barefoot. I know he was packing to move, but still, it was just out of character for him. And he, it was an odd moment. And it's really ingrained in my memory for some reason, but it was a dramatic moment for me anyway. I wanted to embrace the guy. I thought that would be appropriate. And I didn't. And I held out my hand, and we did this awkward back and forth thing, and finally managed to do a handshake. And I said, "Man, I just want to wish you well. I know you're headed for Japan. I just want to wish you well." And Toby was shorter than I am by about 6 inches. And he looked up at me. He's got these bloodshot eyes, and I could smell liquor on his breath. And it's an important point that Toby was never a drinker. Never. I mean, at a barbecue or something, he might have a beer and a half, but he was never a drinker. Certainly not hard liquor. And this smelled like vodka or something. And his eyes were like bloodshot. He looks up at me and he says, "It happened, didn't it, Terry?" And I said, "Yes, my brother, it really happened. And you're not losing your mind." And he said, "But why us?" And I break my gaze with him, and I look down at my shoes, and I just said, "Man, I don't have a clue." And we stood there for a moment in silence, and then I turned and I ran out of the house. Got back in the car. And what was disturbing was, when I went back to the car, there was a blue security police car parked right in back of my wife, who has a truck parked in front of her. So she's hemmed in. You know, I walk back, I look these guys in the eye, I walk back, I get into Carmen Gia. Yeah, I'm scared. My wife is crying. I'm like, "Look, baby, if they wanted us arrested, we'd be in handcuffs, you know, and we're not. So wiggle your way out of here. You know, you're not a parallel park, and let's just go home." And she calmed down, and that's what she did. And when I got home, I grabbed bags of groceries and opened my front door, and my phone's ringing. My wall phone is ringing. And I pick up the phone, say, "Hello," and it was the major, same one that stopped by my hospital room and interrogated me. And he said, "Son, you know what really, really gets my gall," or something like that. I forget the exact phrase he used. I think that may have been it. He said, "To have someone disobey a direct order from me." And he said, "You know, you did that. You disobeyed a direct order from me to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias." And he says, "You know, watch your behind, because we're watching you." And then he said, in kind of a cheery voice, "Did you find your camera and film yet?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't have anything for you." And he said, "Well, it doesn't matter much now," and he hung up. I kind of thought this thing was going to die and go away, but this reaffirmed that no, this thing is headed towards some kind of conclusion. And I figured out that, they really thought, I mean, I had this reputation as a photographer. I had a dark room set up in my house. I think they were convinced that I had a 36 exposure roll of film of this UFO, of this triangle. And God, I wish I did. I wish I did.
And now, have you ever spoken with Toby again after that?
there's a long story about Toby. Toby went to Japan, and this was 77. I finished my enlistment in October of 79. I did not speak to him while he was in Japan. And I got out and went to finish undergrad and go to law school. And early 80s, I had the compulsion to reach out to him. And I had his dad's phone number in Flint, Michigan, and I called his dad. And his dad said, yeah, Toby's here. He's living with me. And he's on the street, and he's not doing real well. But if you leave me your phone number, he knew who I was. He said, leave me your phone number, I'll have him call you. And he never did call me. And a few months went by, and then I called him back, and he said, he didn't say anything. The phone was disconnected. So then we got a call. Like I said, my wife was friends with his wife, with Toby's wife. So she called my wife, Sheila, and said, yeah, I'm back in the States. Toby and I separated and then got divorced. And she said, I'm remarried to a wonderful guy who's a long-haul trucker, and I'm riding around with him. We're going to be in Michigan. Love to see you. And my wife is like, would love to see you too. Please come by. So she did. She and her new husband. We exchanged addresses. And we never sent a Christmas card or anything. She was in our address book till sometime in the 90s and then dropped off. But she told us a story that Toby never did get over this. You know, this. I mean, I had my struggles with it too. I had 40 years of nightmares and, you know, PTSD and odd fears and flashbacks. And she said Toby wasn't doing well. And so I was very sad to hear that. And a few years later, I had finished law school, was licensed to practice in Michigan, and I was on a case that involved the FBI, and I got to know a couple FBI agents. I got to know one in particular pretty well. Great guy, stand-up guy. Just reeked of integrity. I mean, just seemed like a very good man. And sometimes on Friday nights after work, we'd meet at the bar and have a beer and kind of decompress about the day or the week. And one night we're talking and I said, I'd really like to find my friend I was in the Air Force with. Do you think you could find him for me? And he said, I can't open an investigation, but I could do this as a favor for you. He says, yeah, he says, next week, let's do this again next week. And he says, write down everything you can that you know about this guy. His address, ex-wife's name, kids' names, dad's name, dad's phone number, everything, every little piece of detail you can remember, put it down on a piece of paper and bring it to me. And he says, if he's not a fugitive, I'll probably find him for you. So I did that. And a week passes, and I get a call Friday afternoon, and he says, hey, meet me down at the bar. He says, I got some news for you. And I said, okay, cool, good. So I met him, and he was very somber. And he said, did you find my friend? And he says, yeah, I did. Your friend is dead. And I said, he's dead? What do you mean he's dead? He's a young man. How can he be dead? And he said, well, it was an auto accident on Highway 94 in Flint. And he said, these things happen, Terry. It's part of life. These things happen. I'm very sorry. So, I had trouble with that, but I accepted that and moved on with my life. And then in 2017, I couldn't get him off my mind. And I thought, I'm going to find his obit. As long as I'm doing research for this book, I'm going to find his obituary. And I did. And he was alive until September 4th, 2007. He lied to me. I don't know why he lied to me. I don't know if I've got a file that's tagged or something, but he lied to me. And, you know, we could have got back together. And it's just a shame.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate that you weren't able to catch up and kind of, you know, discuss your story and have a little bit more closure on that. So you suspect he may have possibly been interfered with or, you know, had something stop him from finding out this information for you?
Yeah, I believe that. You know, I believe he may have got on a computer or whatever the law enforcement has, that the FBI has. You know, there may have been a tag or something. But they made it clear they didn't want us together.
Now, we have a few minutes left. After this experience in 1977, between then and when you went and had your x-ray and finally realized that there was something wrong, had you had any experiences between then or even recently?
Yeah, I have, actually. In 1987, in the fall of the year in Michigan, it's very pretty, and I used to like to get up on you know, a September, October day on Sunday and, you know, put on some leather and go out and get on my motorcycle and go for a ride. And it was kind of like a family thing. I would leave, let everybody sleep in. I'd leave around 7:30 and I'd be back by 10:30 at the latest. And then I'd make, you know, pancake breakfast for everybody. It was a ritual, a fall ritual. And I got up this morning, that morning in particular, and that was the morning after my wife had her one and only experience that she's ever had in her life. And I should back up because that happened before I went on my motorcycle ride. But that evening, she reached over for me in bed and said I wasn't in bed. And she said that at the foot of the bed, silhouetted by the window in back of her, was a petite Asian, the figure of a petite, what she took to be an Asian woman, in like a robe of some kind with a hood. And she said that she heard this woman say to her, "Go back to sleep, everything's okay." But she never saw her lips move. And that's what she did. She rolled over and went back to sleep. Now, she didn't tell me about this for 3 days, because she was wrestling with this. Was this a dream or was this real? But she, you know, asserted that, yeah, this was real. So, and then this next morning, I go for my motorcycle ride. And I'm, you know, I had 3 or 4 routes that I knew. I knew how long it would take me to go on the run, you know. I mean, I knew where to go. And They were all nice scenic routes with very little traffic, and so I could open my bike up a little bit. And I recall it was a great day, and I'm thinking about work, and I'm coming to a curve in the road, and I'm throttling back from like 80 down to about 65, and my mind's focused on work. And then the next thing I know is I'm doing about 30 miles an hour on a gravel road. Now, I never, ever took my bike on a gravel road. It's dangerous and it's bad for the bike. And I thought, man, I know I'm absent-minded, but this is crazy. And you know what it was like? It was as if you had a piece of motion picture film and you know, cut out a 3-foot section and just spliced it back together. It was absolutely seamless. I was on the bike, like I say, throttling down on pavement, going around this turn, and the next millisecond, I mean, like in the blink of an eye, I'm on this farm road, and I have no idea where I'm at. And I park my bike, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I've got to pay better attention. I turn the bike around, and I head back. I'm about a mile off the blacktop. I got back on blacktop. There's nothing but soybean fields on either side of me. So, you know, there's no landmarks of any kind. And I got back on the road and went home. got home, and my wife is a mess. She's crying, and she's like, "Where the hell have you been?" She says, "I'm about to call the state police. I don't know what happened to you." Days before cell phones, and I'm thinking it's 10:30. You know, I didn't look at my watch because it's underneath all this leather, but I'm thinking it's got to be 10:30 or thereabouts. And then I hear the cartoons, you know, on a cartoon channel that my kids are listening to. And I knew that the time, it wasn't 10:30. And I lost 2 hours. And I have no idea. So.
Wow, that is fascinating. Now, before we close up, is there any other experiences that you had? I heard an interview recently where you said you did have an experience in 2019.
I did.
Tell us about that before we close out.
I sure will. I sleep with my iPhone in the breast pocket of a t-shirt, hooked up to headphones, and I listen to meditative tapes. I also, because it's an iPhone, the battery's bad, I keep it plugged into the wall, but I got a long cord and it never interferes with my sleep. It puts me to sleep and it masks all the ambient noise in the house, you know, all the creaks and knocks and things that are normal that, you know, would freak me out. So it serves those two purposes. And this night, and it was April 16th, 2019, I woke up at 5:55 a.m. out of breath and sweating, and I didn't have any chest pain, but because I couldn't catch my breath, I thought I was having some kind of cardiac event because I'd had a heart attack before. And I told my wife, I said, "You better call an ambulance." And she called an ambulance, and my blood pressure was like 220 over 120. My pulse was tachycardic. It was like 150 or something crazy. I don't know what my oximeter, I don't know what my oxygen saturation was. I'd like to know. I should look that up. And they took me to the hospital. And I'm in the hospital about 30 minutes, and I start to feel back to normal. My blood pressure comes back to normal. My pulse rate drops. And I mean, I know the drill, you know, it's an EKG, a chest X-ray, and cardiac enzymes, you know, that's what they do. And the doctor comes back and says, "You know, you're negative for everything." He said, "I can't find anything wrong with you." He says, "As far as being out of breath and tachycardic and waking up at 5:55, I don't know what happened to you." But he says, I don't see any need to keep you here for observation. We're going to cut you loose at 3:00. So they did. And I went home and I ate dinner. And then I went out for my usual walk after dinner because I felt well enough to do that. And as I'm walking out the front door, it's about 7:30 in the evening, I pulled out my iPhone and I hit my health app because I wanted to see how many steps I had for the day because I knew it had to be under 300, you know. And I try to log a mile and a half a day. Religiously. So I hit my health app, and at the bottom, I think the number of steps that I made for the whole day was 312. And then below that, there was the app has a stairs climbed, and it said 6 flights at 5:24 a.m. Now, 5:24 a.m., that's 31 minutes before I woke up. I should have been sound asleep with my wife. And then I looked at the next screen, and it shows at between 5:23 and 5:24 a red spike that goes up. It's in on the left side on the X axis. It shows 10-foot increments up. And normally, you know, if you climb 6 flights of stairs, you know, unless you're an Olympic athlete, you don't do it in a minute. You do it over a passage of time. And that bottom index runs from left to right and indicates passage of time. So like if I had climbed 6 flights of stairs, I would have had a stair step type readout of red bars that went progressively up as I gained altitude. And I didn't. And I thought, man, so I took my phone to T-Mobile and I'm like, there's got to be something wrong with this. And T-Mobile checked it out and said, we don't find any malfunction, but you might want to take it to the Apple store. And that's what I took it to the Apple store. They were very busy. I gave it to a woman, and she said, I'll run a diagnostic on it for you if you want to come back in a couple hours. And I came back later, and she said, there's nothing wrong with your phone. She said, the health app works fine. So I said, you know, what does this bar mean? And she says, it means you're 60 feet over your house.
We're breaking up, and she said, what does it mean?
She said, it means you were six flights of stairs up. You were 60 feet over your home at 5:24 a.m. Between 5:23 and 5:24 a.m. And I have that. I could send that to you. I have screenshots of that. I'd be happy to send to you.
Wow. And you later had a regression done about this very incident, right?
I did. They're a board-certified psychiatrist here in Dallas. A friend of mine, I actually met him at a MUFON meeting. And he's an older gentleman, but still active in his practice. And he knows this story, and he suggests, he says, you know, if you want a regression, I'm happy to do one for you. And I was kind of reticent to do that, but eventually we did that. And what I recall was going through the ceiling, and it was just dawn outside, going through the roof, being in the air, and going up, and there was a ship, a saucer over me, and the underneath of the thing opened up like a camera lens. And that's as far as we got. My blood pressure spiked, and I was in distress. And he said, well, do another session and see if we can, you know, help you recall more. And then, you know, this COVID thing breaks out. And so we're going to do that whenever we can get out of my house again, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back on to talk about that too. Terry, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was an amazing story. And like I said, I'm so glad you told it. I'm sure it's going to help so many people, you know, who have their own experiences to maybe encourage them to come out and talk about it a little. Your book is Incident at Devil's Den, and your website is terrylovelace.com, right?
That's right. The book is available in Kindle, paperback that has some photographs and drawings in the back of it. And it's also an audio book, and it's only on Amazon. So
very good. Terry, thank you so much again. And I hope we'll talk again in the future.
I'm sure we will. I'll send you that stuff. Thank you so much.
Definitely. All right. Have a good one.
Good night.